Fox Sports 1340 AM presents to you. WMER, Wrestling Marks of Excellence Radio, starring The Firm, J-Lo, Nephew, Corey, and Dr. D, bringing you the latest up-to-date information on professional wrestling and sports entertainment. Now, live from the Fox Sports 1340 studios in Hopewell, Virginia.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Wrestling Marks of Excellence here on 96.9 FM and 1340 AM. As we promised you a couple of weeks ago, we was looking at 1997, WWE or WWF in 1997. We left off at the month of April.
Mm-hmm.
We left off at the month of April after we finished WrestleMania 13. And we talked a little bit about In Your House 14, which is the revenge of The Undertaker. We talked about Bret Hart and Stone Cold Steve Austin there. Then we go into May, and as I mentioned in the last show, May had a place in my heart because it was right here in Richmond, Virginia. May 11th that year was Mother's Day. I remember like it was yesterday. I brought my tickets early, and this place, we had Ticketmaster, and the restaurant store down here called U-Crop. So I went into U-Crop, got my ticket for In Your House, A Cold Day in Hell. I got two tickets. I got one with my dad, and I know I said it was Mother's Day. And my mom, like, you ain't giving me a wrestling ticket? I'm like, you ain't going to wrestling with me. Bump that.
Right.
But I got a car, took care of that morning. But me and dad, my father went to the In Your House pay-per-view, the Richmond Coliseum. It was the first pay-per-view I went to here in Richmond. I've been to a couple others in Maryland and Baltimore, but it was the first one I went to here in Richmond. And it was The Undertaker versus Stone Cold Steve Austin, 1997. Couldn't get any bigger than that. You know, Austin was coming off of his run in April against Bret Hart, WrestleMania. And we're like, man, you know what? I really thought it was the night that Stone Cold Steve Austin was going to pull the trigger and get the win. I really did. I'm like, I couldn't wait to see it. The Austin fame was just getting to where it was getting, as he likes to say on this podcast, he was starting to get white hot. You know, starting to get white hot. Wizard, what would you say, your thoughts on this pay-per-view here, In Your House 15 and Cold Day in Hell, Richmond, Virginia?
I pretty much thought that this was kind of, they were in a predicament in this situation, in the sense of they had Austin, who was white hot, but they were trying to prolong him and Bret as long as they could, and they simply didn't have an opponent for Taker at the time, and they were going to tie in everything, you know. They just didn't have an opponent for Taker, I think. But I think Austin was hot enough where they had to go with that. But the blow-off at the end of the Hart Foundation interfering and everything, it made sense. It made sense. So,
No, go ahead.
No, I was done. Go ahead.
No, it did make sense. It made a lot of sense here because it continued to keep things going with Stone Cold and the Hart Foundation. It kept things going with those guys. And, you know, that was for the most part of that year. That was a big few. Austin, Bret Hart, or Undertaker, Shawn towards the end of the year. It was a lot of things going on in that part for the WWE. You know, we talked about this guy a lot in the last show, Ken Shamrock, and we can't forget that this was his pay-per-view debut for the WWE. You know, they had built it up for a long time with Ken Shamrock. He took on Vader in a no-holds-barred match, and we actually saw the big man tap out here. Vader tapped out here. Ken Shamrock got the win. We talked about Ken Shamrock, and we'll see the progression of Ken Shamrock towards the end of the year, because they always talk about how Kurt Angle picked it up fast. In my opinion, I thought Ken Shamrock picked up professional wrestling real fast as well.
Yeah, he did.
And they put him into a main event, you know, by the end of the year. But Ken Shamrock was legitimately, you know, one of those guys at this pay-per-view that I can remember standing out in the match between him and Vader. I'm like, you know what? This is pretty darn good. Ken Shamrock is actually a good man. This is one of the few a good hand. He'll be on here because I was a UFC guy. I remember watching UFC, you know, and watching Ken Shamrock come to WWE. And still at 97, those lines were still a little bit blurred. You didn't know if he was a work or a reality or a shoot. But, you know, Ken Shamrock moved on here. And you still have the rise of the Hart Foundation, too, here at this pay-per-view as well. The Hart Foundation, Owen Hart, and the British Bulldogs, took on the Legion of Doom for the tag team championship, where the Legion of Doom actually won this match. You know, so you had that feud still going on with the Hart Foundation, hadn't really found their way yet, but it was moving. moving in the right direction there?
So let me touch on at this point, let me touch on this with the Hart Foundation at this point, because by then they were moving so ridiculously fast as far as them skyrocketing in heat. And it just, and at this time, I feel like WWE wasn't booking venues months in advance. So smart by WWE that it seemed like, and you could attest to this because you were definitely watching at that time. Mm-hmm. It seemed like they were alternating weeks by the summertime between Canada and the United States, didn't it?
Yeah, it seemed like they were. You know, it was a big, it seemed that way. It had a big feel for big Canadian crowd, put it that way. The Canadians were, you could tell the Canadian presence in the WWE. You could tell.
Absolutely.
You could really tell how the crowd almost was kind of split from those Canadian Americans, if I want to create a term there, your Canadian Americans to your plain Americans. It was really creating a separation. And people got to realize, those who are listening to us that didn't live in 97, during this age, there was a lot of factions in the WWE. You had a lot of factions. You had the Nation of Domination that was there. You had the Hart Foundation that was a faction. Later on, we end up getting Savio Vega's faction. I can't remember what it was called, Los Boricos, Borico, and I messed it up probably. And then you end up getting the Crushes faction as well. So you end up, WWE was in this faction stage where they had a lot of factions, you know. And so,
yep.
But the Hart Foundation, you could really tell it in the crowd that your Canadian Americans or your Canadians, period, were rooting for the Hart Foundation. It was a divide.
How do I want to put it? I think there was a divide only because fans were starting to root for whoever they wanted to root for. Because at this point, by this time, I mean, Shawn Michaels was a face, but was he really? By this point, he was just Shawn Michaels at this point. Austin was definitely, you know, being booked as a face, but he still had heel tendencies. Undertaker was a champion. I mean, he was a face, but he was... And that's another thing, too. Undertaker is the champion, and he's like the third or fourth attraction in the company at this point. Because
yeah.
Austin, the Hart, HBK were all ahead of him at this time. And then it was Taker, and it was weird because it seemed like Taker had no opponents, which is what I was saying earlier. It just seemed like they got the belt to him, in which, you know, rumors will always fly about where that was supposed to go, because we don't know. I mean, granted, we weren't in creative. We don't know. I mean, as far as we know, that was the plan for all along, was for Taker to be champion, but we don't know that. I mean, Taker could have been the fail-safe, and that's not a knock on him or not a thing. They wouldn't have confidence in him being champion, because clearly he's an institution of the company. But it just feels like something around that time, with Shawn losing the smile and being injured, it just seems like a lot of things were written on the fly going into that WrestleMania, at least. But, you know, fast forward, we're in, you know, May, June now. You also get the evolution of Mick Foley, because they're
yeah.
really starting to, you know, delve deep into Mick Foley's character. And kudos to whoever's idea that was, because that really, really broadened. I mean, it really, really, you know, showed what Mick Foley had to offer. And it also helped kind of, you know, you got the sprinklings of WWE, even though all of Mick Foley's gimmicks are like true characters, you could see them going away from the cartoonish characters and starting to move into more reality-based or more edginess. Like, even though we got Dude Love, Cactus Jack, Mankind out of all that, they still were saying these are the personalities or personas of Mick Foley. So it was a very different time. You could see things starting to change in wrestling, in WWE especially.
You know, you say that because that year that we go in the month of May and June, in my view, Mankind was my pick for the King of the Ring.
Oh, a lot of people. Oh, a lot of people.
You know, we look at it, and this is the true eight-man King of the Ring bracket that you had in there. Your final eight guys were Ahmed Johnson, Hunter Hearst Helmsley, Crush, Goldust, Jerry Lawler, Mankind, and Savio Vega. And looking at those guys, I'm like, yo, Mankind has – I'm thinking, you know, not Mick Foley. I'm like, Mankind has this. I really think this could be Mankind's thing. And we know that eventually he got to the finals and Hunter Hearst Helmsley, Triple H, whatever you want to call him, gets the win. But I also – like, the storyline behind this was kind of great because you think Triple H wasn't even supposed to be back in the tournament because he lost to Ahmed Johnson by DQ. And we go back to that Raw – and they flipped the rules because he said he didn't understand and didn't know what was going on, and they allowed him to wrestle again. And so they threw him back in there. He ended up beating Crush, and then he ended up having to face Ahmed Johnson. So it was kind of weird how Triple H ended up finagling his way to the finals of the King of the Ring. But he finally gets his King of the Ring win. You know, and back then, and the King of the Ring, you like, you know, this guy's in line to move up, because most King of the Rings, after they won the King of the Ring, they kind of got a little bit of a jetpack on their back. You know, the King of the Ring missed something back then.
Yeah. I miss the King of the Ring now. And I miss it now because I miss it as a pay-per-view because it was just the importance. Like it just seems like now when they throw it on, it just seems like, okay, it's thrown on. But the fans now don't get the nostalgic, of it, you know, so that does disappoint me.
It does. I mean, you think about it. Look at some of the people who've won the King of the Ring, some of the legends. You had Don Morocco who won. He was a worker. Harley Race. Just the name Harley Race alone, you know, talks about how the work that he put in. You had Randy Savage, who was a winner of King of the Ring. You had DiBiase. You had Owen Hart. You had Bret Hart. So you had workers. These were legitimate guys who put in work in the company. And I would not say all those guys are Hall of Famers. And Triple H will be one. So when you won the King of the Ring back then, it meant something to win the King of the Ring.
Yes, it did. Well, you were getting title shots. They would say the winner of the King of the Ring would get a WWE title shot, too. Because I do remember that. I know they definitely did it for Kurt Angle. That I definitely remember when Kurt won the King of the Ring in 2000. He got a WWF championship match.
You know, and so it meant something. So looking at that, knowing the history behind that, when I was there, like, okay, Triple H got this, like, hey, Hunter Hearst Helmsley, like, he's in line. Something great is going to happen, you know. And eventually it did, but really thought, you know, he had already had the IC title. We're like, you know, could Hunter take that next level, that next step in 97? And that's what I was thinking after he won the King of the Ring. It fit him. You know, it fit. Even though I wanted Mankind to win, it fit the Hunter Hearst Helmsley gimmick. You know, the British aristocrat, it fit what WWE was trying to do at that time in 1997.
Yeah, it does. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that King of the Ring was good. You know, all the matches that was on that King of the Ring card, if we go back and look at, I believe it was Shawn Michaels and Stone Cold again.
Yeah, now let me touch on that. Let me touch on that. How do I want to put this? I feel as though we never got the full potential of what we could have got out of Shawn Michaels and Steve Austin as tag champions. Part of that is because I think Shawn just never had an interest in being in a tag team, even if it is with the hottest commodity they had. I just feel as though Shawn just wanted to be Shawn on his own. be the world champion, and it never materialized what it could have been. Because Sean and Steve, that was great. That was a great team as tag team champions. But it's like we never got anything out of it. And then all of a sudden, Sean gets hurt again, and Stone Cold's looking for a tag partner. It just materializes into something else. And I always thought that was just something lost. But also with that King of the Ring, if I'm not mistaken, I think Sean and Brett were supposed to fight then. And I think Brett got hurt at that time. There were so many. That's ultimately the caption. If you were to put WWF 1997 as a picture, the caption would read the start and stop of Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels, because that was the underlining, you know, premise of that entire year, was getting Shawn versus Bret, because it was the rematch everybody wanted that hadn't happened. So it was in a way, it was like, are we ever going to get Shawn and Bret? It's like, we were supposed to get Shawn versus Bret at WrestleMania. Didn't happen. Supposed to get Shawn versus Bret at, I think, sometime in between WrestleMania and SummerSlam. Didn't happen. Definitely was supposed to get it at King of the Ring. Didn't happen. I mean, it just, there were so many start and stops. And Shawn Michaels versus Steve Austin was a tremendous match on that card, but unless it's, like I said, we weren't on creative, so we don't know where they were going, but they kind of painted themselves into a corner, because who do you put over in that match? Like, you're not having Shawn lose, pretty much, in which, on the low, that nobody even realized, Shawn Michaels, he didn't even lose a match in, like, almost 2 years from since he lost, from the time he lost to Sid at Survivor Series 96 all the way pretty much through 97, and I'm including that fluke match with him and Hunter Hurst for the European Championship, Shawn didn't lose until almost WrestleMania that next year, pretty much. So you weren't, and was Shawn really losing at that time? Probably not. Are you gonna have Austin lose to Michaels? No. Well, Austin's the hottest thing you got at the moment. You're not having him lose. So it was just weird. I think they just put on a good match. It wasn't anything else to go with that, but they put on a good match. But go ahead, what were the other matches?
They definitely put on a good match. You had Taker at this time. Championship match was Undertaker taking on Farouk. This is Farouk one of his few chances he had actually to win the world.
Now, I know you remember this. Listen, even at that time, even at 13, you know, I'm like, Farouk could win the championship. They played the race card so heavy building into that match. And it just, looking back on it, I'm like, yo, Farouk could have won that. They could have put the belt on him, and nobody would have been the wiser.
I was rooting for him. I was rooting for him.
Oh, I know you were. That didn't even surprise me.
I know I was. Because I was thinking, okay, Will, and this, even at the age, even at 17 years old, 16, 17 years old, and 97 at this point, I'm thinking, will WWE be like, I'm thinking, shoot, he got it in WCW. Why not get it in WWE? So he can go ahead and be there. First African American champion in both organizations. I thought he was going to pull the trigger on that. I thought he was going to let him be both.
You know what? You know what's funny that you say that, because we talked about the Harts, but at this time, and maybe a couple of months before that, the Nation was just as hot as the Harts.
Yeah,
they were just as specifically when. And that's why I said a couple months before, late 96 going into 97, the Nation was at its hottest. And that's why I thought they were honestly going to give it to Farouk, because it just seemed like it was so out of the blue that Farooq was such a random opponent for Taker. It was like, wait a minute, he could get this. Even if it was for a month, it just felt like he could get it.
Right. Well, my boy, and let's remind the audience, this is the Nation of Domination with Clarence Mason, D'Lo Brown, Crush, and Savio Vega.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the Nation with The Rock,
but
D'Lo
we'll
Brown.
Get into that because we're almost getting there. So
we're almost getting there. Yeah, we're almost getting there because this match right here helped us to get to that point. Because
yep.
if you remember, when Farooq lost because Savio Vega and Crush kind of interfered and distracted him a little bit, and
mm-hmm.
it helped him. So he ended up kicking those two out of the Nation, and that's when they
yep.
went on to create their own groups. I think it was Disciples of Apocalypse, as I tried to
yep.
remember earlier.
Los Barriquas.
So you're at this part right here. Clarence Mason stayed. D'Lo Brown stayed. You know, that should be a trivia question. What was the original Nation of Domination? I wonder how many people get that right. But
yeah,
anyway.
I know.
But that's where we're at right now.
Don't forget,
you know?
D'Lo, at the end of that match, the other seeds were planted because Ahmed Johnson all of a sudden puts down Taker.
Yeah.
And we're like, what's going on here that he takes out Taker?
Yeah. And there lies again, okay, we didn't get Farooq, but will we get Ahmed Johnson, as we mentioned in the last show, would Ahmed Johnson
mm-hmm.
be the first African-American champion? And these questions were real because, think about it, WCW was still running – WCW was running high at this time. It was getting cranked up, as you would say.
WCW was – at this point,
it was already
WCW was on another planet compared to
right.
WWF at this point. There was no competition at this point because WCW, like the NWO at this time, oh my gosh, they were killing because WCW 97 was all, you know, and it's a shame, just to digress for a second, it's a shame to think that as badly and poorly booked as WCW was and how it was managed, they were able to pull off not having Sting wrestle for an entire year. Plus, Sting didn't wrestle for a good 13, maybe 14, wait a minute. September 96, I think he wrestled maybe a couple of house shows here and there. But that's besides the point. Realistically, from September 96 to September, October, November, December. So for 15 months, they didn't have Sting wrestle or talk. And it goes into Starrcade in D.C. being the biggest storyline in wrestling.
Yeah.
How do you get that out of WCW for what you remember how WCW ended and how bad it was booked and how bad it was managed? They pulled off that kind of storyline.
They put that storyline off. Look at the matches we're naming. Raw was giving you pay-per-view quality matches. They were putting pay-per-view. You saw the champion every week. You saw marquee matchups on Monday Night Raw. You know what I'm saying?
Sure did.
Marquee matches on Monday Night Raw, even after pay-per-view, usually your big pay-per-view, your big Monday Night Raw or your big show is either your go-home show into a pay-per-view or the Monday after the pay-per-view, because you got to mind you here, 97, everybody didn't have the internet.
Nope.
Again. So everybody wanted to tune in, and everybody didn't buy pay-per-views. Everybody was going to tune in to see what has happened on your pay-per-view. So mind you, going into 97, going into the next night, which is January 9th, after the King of the Ring, Raw did a 2.2 as a rating.
Mm-hmm.
Nitro did a 3.4.
Yep.
So you're looking at, like, we just got off a big pay-per-view, got off the King of the Ring, we crowned a new King of the Ring, and we still ain't beat WCW.
Yeah, but you know what, though? At that point, They had Dennis Rodman coming off a championship. That was a big deal at that time.
Oh yeah, Rodman was the man. I mean, the Bulls had won championship. Rodman was out there everywhere doing the Dennis Rodman thing. You know, I think we mentioned it in one of our groups we talked in. If social media had been around with Dennis Rodman, he may not have had a job, or he might have had his own, may have had his own reality show. But nonetheless, you know, they was doing their own thing there. So they had the mainstream. Eric Bischoff did a good job of taking mainstream stars, your top stars, your Karl Malones, your Jay Leno's, your Dennis Rodman. People forget Shaquille O'Neal back in the day. He knew how to take the big star and put them in a position for a WCW. We all talk about Vince McMahon now with your Floyd Mayweathers and all that. And that was fine. And Vince was doing some of that in the WrestleMania. But Eric would do it on – they would show up on WCW Nitro. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
They would show up on Nitro. It wasn't just a pay-per-view, but we saw the big stars in WWE on, or WWF at the time on their pay-per-views. WCW, you didn't know you were going to see a big star on Monday night or not.
Sure didn't. And WCW was giving their pay-per-view quality matches on purpose for free. So,
So 97 was a different era there. So we got the pay-per-view. We got the King of the Ring out the way. So we moving into the month of July. And one thing about July, if you really look at it, this is – and I had to – when I was doing research, had to go look at the ratings because it was a big time – here, because I'm listening to 83 weeks, you know, and the time they were talking about 83 weeks going on. But did you know July 21st, WWE actually got a win in the ratings?
That was probably the last one up until they won again in December of 98 then, wasn't it? It had to be.
Yeah, and they got a win because Nitro didn't come on.
Oh, well, that doesn't count. That didn't even count then, really.
Yeah, they didn't get going. They ended up with a 4.1, but that was July 21st. You know, back then, a lot of the channels would switch up. You had the Westminster Dog Show. You had different things going on TNN, TBS. So a lot of shows would switch off and on. Some nights you would, some weeks you wouldn't get a Nitro or you wouldn't get a Monday Night Raw. Just something I thought about when I was doing research. Like, you know what? They did get a win, but no one talks about that. And it wasn't a head-to-head win, per se. But we're moving into the month of July with the WWE. And which this is the one that we wanted to talk about. This is your Canadian Stampede. This is the one from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. The Hart Foundation. And this was all about the Hart Foundation. About them coming back to Calgary, Alberta, Canada, about them coming home. And we mentioned earlier, and we talked about this within a month or two of being within the company, and you got Ken Shamrock already in a main event match here with Goldust and the Legion of Doom and Stone Cold Steve Austin, who took on the Hart Foundation in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. What do you remember leading up to this match here? Was it in July?
At this point, this was when, like I mentioned a little bit earlier in the show, is that it seemed like they were going back and forth between Canada and the United States every week. And we were getting to where, you know, the Hart Foundation was just hot. But you had to branch stuff off, but you wanted to capitalize on the Hart Foundation as a unit. So what better way than to put all of them together, and where's your pay-per-view going? It's going to Calgary. You better believe with the Hart Foundation, the way they were riding at that point, you got a pay-per-view in Calgary. Oh, you're going to milk that. You're going to milk. And I just remember going into that pay-per-view, they were the biggest baby faces going into that pay-per-view. It was uncanny. To this day, that's one of the biggest pops in a long time. Because that was crazy. But on the other hand, I remember Austin gaining a lot of steam. Austin was gaining a lot of steam. Shamrock was too. Shamrock, like you mentioned earlier, Shamrock was a big deal at that time. Huge deal. Dare I say, he was probably... off the top of my head, if he had to rate faces in the company just purely of what they were doing, it was probably Taker, Shawn, Austin, Shamrock. And I know people are like, what? This is 97, people. Austin was getting to where he became. But he was not bigger than Shawn or Taker at that time. He wasn't. He just wasn't.
And as we mentioned, Shawn and Taker, you know, it was only with this pay-per-view right here was one of the only pay-per-views, if not the only pay-per-view, where Shawn or Taker was not in the main event throughout
the year. In 97, you got that
right. In 97. So Shawn and Taker was either one of them or both of them was in the main event for the whole year of 97. You know, Vince wanted to keep his stars, keep those two guys in the forefront. And that's where they're at now. You know, they are the heart and soul of the WWE. If you imagine, and you know, we talk about it, in 97, people were leaving and going to WCW. If either one of these guys had left in 1997, company was done.
It was done.
They were done.
It was done.
If
Taker and
Shawn
would have
left,
he
was done.
Here's the thing. People don't realize that, and it's like, I know how good Austin was going to be. We see how good Austin became. But unbiasedly speaking, because I know Shawn's my guy, but Shawn or Taker leaving, that would have broke, because you didn't have those anchors there to give, because that's the thing. You got to have Shawn and Taker there to give time for Rock, Mankind, Stone Cold, Triple H, for all of them to develop. You had to have somebody still up there at the top, and that was Shawn and Taker and Brett. But Brett was in and out at this point, and he had been hurt, and he'd been gone for a little while too. So you kind of had to rely on Taker and Shawn. And I know people are saying, well, Shawn was gone a lot too. Yeah, but Shawn leaving would have been a huge deal, because pretty much the entire clique would have been gone.
It wouldn't only been a big deal on TV. It would have been a personal blow, in my opinion, to Vince McMahon.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
He emotionally invested in Shawn. He mostly invested in Taker, which everybody says he is. Undertaker is Vince McMahon's greatest creation. You know, for your greatest creation, it would have been like Frankenstein all over again. You know, you create something and it turns it back on you. If Taker or Shawn would have went down to WCW, it would have been done. WWE would have closed the doors in 1997, regardless of how, as you mentioned, Shawn Michaels, I mean, as you mentioned, Stone Cold Steve Austin, Goldust, Farooq, The Rock, Mankind, all those guys. I think it would have been very hard to right the ship if Shawn Michaels or Undertaker had left.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Like I said, there would Rock, Austin, Mankind, that Hunter Hearst Helmsley, I don't think that would have materialized like people think it would have, because like I said, none of them were ready at this point. All of them were still mid-card at this point. All four of them.
Mm-hmm.
The four staples of the Attitude Era. And I leave Taker out of that, because Taker's on his own island at this point. But you're pretty much your cornerstones of the Attitude Era were Austin, Rock, Triple H, and Foley. Those were your cornerstones of the Attitude Era. So with that being said, you know, I don't think they would have had the time to develop and properly go through the channels like they did if there weren't other guys around for them to, you know, have that, have the luxury of going through the motions. So, yeah, I think they just lucked out.
It is. And, you know, you mentioned earlier about the Canadian fan. It seemed like they were in Canada one week in the United States. They actually wasn't in Canada. What happened, what it was that the WWE was up in the northeast part of the United States a lot. It was near West Virginia, your Hartford, Connecticut, your New York, your Detroit, Michigans, your Iowa, and your, to where the Canadian people was easier to get to.
Okay.
Where that crowd was easy to come over there. And that was a strong crowd. So your Detroit and stuff like that was close to Canada.
Well, to that credit, they were also, though, they were running a lot of Canadian towns, but I remember them being in Nova Scotia. When the last time WWE been in Nova Scotia?
Yeah, there was in Nova Scotia. That July 21st show that I mentioned, that was the night they was in Nova Scotia.
Yeah. So they're in Nova Scotia. They're in Edmonton. I think they're in Winnipeg at some point. Like, they're hitting these shows. And only thing I'm thinking is that I'm wondering, like, were these house shows? And then they got converted? Or they were... They lucked out. They lucked out.
They lucked out, and then because their Canadian stars were hot, you know, they went to Ottawa, they went to Cornwall. When was the last time they've been to Cornwall, Ontario, Canada, or Monday Night Raw?
Exactly.
You know,
for Monday Night Raw.
Yeah, so it was in those type places where the Hart Foundation was really running rampant and running wild, as they say, brother. But you know, so the WWE there. Canadian Stampede, as we mentioned, was a good pay-per-view for the WWE. It was a good pay-per-view for the WWE at this time. As we mentioned, it was the Hart Foundation taking on Stone Cold Steve Austin's team, if you want to call it a 10-man tag match, where it was Ken Shamrock, Goldust, the Legion of Doom, and Stone Cold Steve Austin taking on the Hart Foundation, Bret Hart, Brian Pillman, the British Bulldog, Jim Neidhart, and Owen Hart. And, of course, ladies and gentlemen, you're not a rocket scientist. You know who won this one, right? It was the Hart Foundation. There was no way in the world the Hart Foundation
was not going to win this one.
You know what was really stuck out to me in this wizard?
Mm-hmm.
We did our show, our prediction show. If you want to listen to it, check it out on iTunes, our prediction show for Extreme Rules that's coming up on this Sunday. This pay-per-view only had 5 matches on it.
Well, at this time, this was still the time where your in your houses were still short. They were just over 2 hours, but this is when it was starting to get that they were becoming regular pay-per-views. But the 5 matches they had, my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, the 5 matches that we had, you had the Godwins, who took on the new Blackjacks, which was Blackjack Bradshaw. For those who don't know, that is Bradshaw, who, as we know now, and Barry Windham. You know, that was the new Blackjacks with a tag team. You had Hunter only with China, who took on Mankind. You had the great Suzuki, who took on Taka Bikinoshu. You had The Undertaker, who took on Vader. And then you had the Hart Foundation.
Yeah, and that's all the card they needed, to be honest. That's all they needed.
Yeah, and those matches right there were for good matches for that time and for that pay-per-view and for that show. So coming out of that pay-per-view, coming out of the Canadian Stampede pay-per-view, we moved into August, where you pick up your SummerSlam. Now, the main match here for the SummerSlam was at the Continental Airline Arena. The main match here at SummerSlam, you had The Undertaker taking on Bret Hart. As we mentioned, Bret Hart and the Hart Foundation was running rapid here, and Bret Hart thought he was going to get the World Heavyweight title back here at this SummerSlam. And, you know, SummerSlam here, always loved it. One thing about SummerSlam growing up, especially in 97, you knew SummerSlam rolls around, it's almost time to go back to school. That's how I picked it. Like, okay, SummerSlam is getting close to time to go to school at this point. You know, you're sitting here like, man, what are we going to do here? But SummerSlam was actually pretty good this year. That year, SummerSlam was actually pretty good. Had some good matches on the card. Very good matches on the card. We saw a steel cage match. Good European Championship was actually defended this year. And we've talked about Ken Shamrock. Now, we keep talking about Ken Shamrock. Shamrock started in the WWE. He's already going for the European title by this time in August.
Yeah.
And when I say European title, remember, Davey Boy Smith had the European title. He was, I don't want to call it holding hostage, but he had been a European champion for a while. And so you had Ken Shamrock going against Davey Boy Smith, which was a pretty good match. Davey Boy Smith ends up winning this match over Ken Shamrock by disqualification. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, the fact that Ken Shamrock was in a European championship match, because back then it was progression. You won the European title, then you might have went up to the Intercontinental title, and next thing you know, you're wrestling for the world title. So what do you remember from this from the SummerSlam pay-per-view in 1997? Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
No, no.
I can hear you.
I
think I'm muted.
Oh, my bad.
That was on me. That was on me. So what was the question again? I didn't hear it.
What did you get from the pay-per-view in 1997, the SummerSlam pay-per-view? What were your thoughts after this pay-per-view or leading up to this pay-per-view?
Well, I like that you got the finale, or at least what it seemed like. You got the finale of Hunter and Mankind, or Hunter, you know. So you got the blow-off with the cage match there. As good as the matches were, the only thing that had real builds were, I mean, everything centered around the Hart Foundation matches. But you also saw this time they kind of trying to individualize each one of them into their own storylines. So you had Pillman and Goldust, and you had Shamrock and Bulldog. The main focus, which, you know, good booking from the month before, they had Austin pinned by Owen the month before, which helped make, you know, a SummerSlam match right there pretty much. So all in all, I thought the pay-per-view was very good, but other than Austin's match ending the way it was, because I'm sure it would have ended differently, that and Sean as the referee with Bret and Taker were done excellently.
Yeah, and, you know, and this was the one, you know, and we go to the SummerSlam 1997. If I'm not mistaken, this is where Austin gets dropped on his neck.
Sure is.
Austin gets dropped on his neck by Owen Hart. Owen Hart is the Intercontinental Champion, you know, at this time. And so we look at it here, and if it hadn't been for the smarts of Earl Hebner, the referee, you know, knows there's something wrong with Austin, and Austin gets the roll-up pin over Owen Hart to become the new Intercontinental Champion. You know, it would have been different because, remember, Austin was out for a while after this because being dropped on his neck, almost paralyzed. He talks about it all the time. He losing feeling in his legs, in his hands, in the ring, because of a pile driver. That's what is significant about this SummerSlam. You know, this match would have went on a little bit. It could have went on a little bit longer, but had to end early. And you know, and it changed the course of where things were supposed to go for Stone Cold Steve Austin. Now he got to where he wanted to be at, being a WWE champion, a WWF champion. But I think it would have happened much sooner than it did if he hadn't got dropped.
I'm going to disagree. I don't think he was going to get the belt before. I think WrestleMania was absolutely when he was going to get it, without a shadow of a doubt. That moment was built for Austin getting the belt at WrestleMania. I think he would have ran with the Intercontinental Championship longer. Absolutely. But WrestleMania, that was where it was going to be. That was absolutely where it was going to be. Now, whether it was Brett or Shawn dropping it, and that's what we'll get into later, because I guess we should probably stop here at August.
Yeah.
And then do another part. Yeah. So, because that's where I think they were going, but I'll save that. But that is where I think we were going to get, you know, before the screw job, I think we were going to get Austin and Brett at WrestleMania.
And we also got to remember, you know, leading up to this pay-per-view, that summer, Austin had already been tag team champion with Dude Love. He told Vince McMahon, you know, if I don't win the title from Bret Hart, blah, 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 you know, I'm going to end up kissing his butt, all that. So he figured he needed to be the WWF champion. He figured he needed to be the WWF champion, end up getting the tag team championship. They end up losing those titles. And then it gets to the Intercontinental Championship, Owen Hart, and as we mentioned, getting dropped on his neck. So this SummerSlam wasn't a bad SummerSlam at all. Some things in that SummerSlam that made it quirky or different. You know, the title match. The title match, we had Bret Hart taking on The Undertaker here. We got to talk about the special guest referee before we close the show out, which happened to be Shawn Michaels.
Exactly.
Happened to be Shawn Michaels here because there lies again, we mentioned it in the pay-per-views in 1997, it was either Undertaker, Shawn Michaels, or Bret Hart that was in the main event. And so, therefore, these three guys are intertwined. The three, you call the other four the cornerstones of the Attitude Era. These guys right here was the ones that would help putting those cornerstones in place in the pay-per-views. You know, Undertaker, Bret Hart, and Shawn Michaels had to be around for this time. And this match right here, with Shawn Michaels being a special referee and Bret Hart defeating the Undertaker for the championship, was a good match.
Absolutely.
But it also showed the animosity again against Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the realness of that just made it even better.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, you know, we're going to stop right there at SummerSlam. We'll finish out the rest of the year of 1997. And
ground zero.
Give us your comments, give us your thoughts. What do you think of the show? Do you like the part one? Did you enjoy part one? Did you enjoy part two? Hit us up on, leave a comment on iTunes, leave a 5-star review. If you're listening to it on YouTube, hit the subscribe button, listen to us. Also, go back and listen to some of our archive shows on iTunes, subscribe, some great interviews with some of the famous stars, and big stars like Vader. Bill Alfonso, one of our very first shows of the Wrestling Marks are Excellence. With Diamond Dallas Page, when he was first coming out with DDP Yoga. So go back and listen to some archive shows. Hall of Fame, Abdullah Biff Butcher, Miz, Mick Foley, Archive. Hit the subscribe button on YouTube, on iTunes. Hit the subscribe button also on YouTube. Check out our prediction show for Extreme Rules 2018. Next week, we'll finish 1997, and we'll also give you our thoughts on the Extreme Rules pay-per-view. Wizard, take us home.
Hey, if you're not confirmed, consider yourself denied.
End of story, ladies and gentlemen. Good night.